women and photographers. As I handed the envelope to the magistrate, the photographers went into action. The magistrate shielded himself from the camera flashes and then invited Yusuf and myself into his chambers to discuss the matter privately. He was a reasonable man and said his office was always open to us, but that excessive publicity would only worsen matters. From the magistrate's office, we went straight to the township where the demonstration was taking place, and even from half a mile away, we heard the robust singing of our volunteers and the great crowd of supporters who had come to encourage them. At the scene, we found the high metal gates to the township locked and our volunteers waiting patiently outside, demanding entrance. There were 52 volunteers in all, both Africans and Indians, and a crowd of several hundred enthusiastic spectators and journalists. Walter was at the head of the defiers. His presence was evidence that we meant business. But the guiding spirit of the demonstrators was Nana Sita, who, despite his arthritis, was moving among the demonstrators in high spirits, clapping them on the back and bolstering their confidence with his own. For the first hour, there was a standoff. The police were uncharacteristically restrained, and their behavior baffled us. Was their restraint a strategy to exhaust the volunteers? Were they waiting for the journalists to depart and then stage a massacre under the cover of darkness? Or were they faced with the dilemma that by arresting us, which is what they would have normally done, they would be doing the very thing we wanted? But even while we were wondering, the situation suddenly changed. The police ordered the gates opened. Immediately, the volunteers surged through the gates, thus breaking the law. A police lieutenant blew a whistle, and seconds later, the police surrounded the volunteers and began arresting them. The campaign was underway. The demonstrators were carted off to the local police station and charged. That same evening, the leaders of the Action Committee, which included Oliver Tambo, Yusuf Kachalia, and myself, attended a meeting in the city to discuss the day's events and to plan for the week ahead. It was near the area where the second batch of defiers, led by Flag Boshielo, chairman of the central branch of the ANC, were courting arrest. Shortly after 11 o'clock, we found them marching in unison in the street. At 11, curfew regulations went into effect, and Africans needed a permit to be outside. We emerged from our meeting at midnight. I felt exhausted and was thinking not of defiance, but of a hot meal and a night's sleep. At that moment, a policeman approached Yusuf and me. It was obvious that we were going home, no protesting. "No, Mandela," the policeman called out. "You can't escape." He pointed with his nightstick to the police wagon parked nearby and said, "Into the van." I felt like explaining to him that I was in charge of running the campaign on a day-to-day basis and was not scheduled to defy and be arrested until much later. But of course, that would have been ridiculous. I watched as he arrested Yusuf, who burst out laughing at the irony of it all. It was a lovely sight to see him smiling as he was led away by the police. Moments later, Yusuf and I found ourselves among the more than 50 of our volunteers led by Flag Boshielo, who were being taken in trucks to the red brick police station known as Marshall Square. As the leaders of the Action Committee, we were worried that the others would wonder at our absence, and I was concerned about who would be running the campaign. But spirits were high. Even on the way to prison, the van swayed to the rich voices of the defiers, singing, "God bless Africa." That first night, in the drill yard, one of us was pushed so violently by a white warder that he fell down some steps and broke his ankle. I protested to the warder about his behavior, and he lashed out at me by kicking me in the shin. I demanded that the injured man receive medical attention, and we initiated a small but vocal demonstration. We were curtly informed that the injured man could make a request for a doctor the next day if he so wished. We were aware throughout the night of his acute pain. Until then, I had spent bits and pieces of time in prison. But this was my first concentrated experience. Marshall Square was squalid, dark, and dingy. But we were all together, and so impassioned and spirited that I barely noticed my surroundings. The camaraderie of our fellow defiers made the 2 days pass very quickly. On that first day of the Defiance campaign, more than 250 volunteers around the country violated various unjust laws and were imprisoned. It was an auspicious beginning. Our troops were orderly, disciplined, and confident. Over the next 5 months, 8,500 people took part in the campaign. Doctors, factory workers, lawyers, teachers, students, ministers defied and went to jail. They sang, "Hey Milan, open the jail doors, we want to enter." The campaign spread throughout the Witwatersrand, to Durban, to Port Elizabeth, East London, and Cape Town, and smaller towns in the eastern and western Cape. Resistance was beginning to percolate even in the rural areas. For the most part, the offenses were minor, and the penalties ranged from no more than a few nights in jail to a few weeks, with the option of a fine, which rarely exceeded £10. The campaign received an enormous amount of publicity, and the membership of the ANC shot up from some 20,000 to 100,000, with the most spectacular increase occurring in the Eastern Cape, which contributed half of all new members. During the 6 months of the campaign, I traveled a great deal throughout the country. I generally went by car, leaving at night or very early in the morning. I toured the Cape, Natal, and the Transvaal, explaining the campaign to small groups, sometimes going from house to house in the townships. Often my task was to iron out differences in areas that were about to launch actions or had recently done so. In those days, when mass communication for Africans was primitive or non-existent, politics were parochial. We had to win people over one by one. On one occasion, I drove to the Eastern Cape to resolve a dispute involving Alcott Gwenchi, who was running the campaign in East London. Gwenchi had been a successful shopkeeper and had played an important role in organizing East London for the stay-at-home of June 26th, 2 years before. He had briefly gone to jail at the beginning of the Defiance campaign. He was a strong and able man, but he was an individualist who ignored the advice of the executive and took decisions unilaterally. He was now at odds with his own executive, which was mainly populated with intellectuals. Gwenchi knew how to exploit certain issues in order to discredit his opponents. He would speak before local members, who were workers, not intellectuals, and say, in Xhosa, never English, for English was the language of the intellectuals, "Comrades, I think you know that I have suffered for the struggle. I had a good job and then went to jail at the beginning of the Defiance campaign, and I lost that job. Now that I am out of prison, these intellectuals have come along and said, 'Gwenchi, we are better educated than you. We are more capable than you. Let us run this campaign.'" When I investigated the situation, I found that Gwenchi had indeed ignored the advice of the executive. But the people were behind him, and he had created a disciplined and well-organized group of volunteers who had defied in an orderly fashion even while Gwenchi was in prison. Although I thought Gwenchi was wrong for disregarding the executive, he was doing a good job and was so firmly entrenched that he could not easily be dislodged. When I saw the members of the executive, I explained that it was impractical to do anything about the situation now, but if they wanted to remedy it, they must defeat him at the next election. It was one of the first times that I saw that it was foolhardy to go against the masses of people. It is no use to take an action to which the masses are opposed, for it will then be impossible to enforce. The government saw the campaign as a threat to its security and its policy of apartheid. They regarded civil disobedience not as a form of protest, but as a crime, and were perturbed by the growing partnership between Africans and Indians. Apartheid was designed to divide racial groups, and we showed that different groups could work together. The prospect of a united front between Africans and Indians, between moderates and radicals, greatly worried them. The nationalists insisted that the campaign was instigated and led by communist agitators. The Minister of Justice announced that he would soon pass legislation to deal with our defiance, a threat he implemented during the 1953 parliamentary session with the passage of the Public Safety Act, which empowered the government to declare martial law and to detain people without trial, and the Criminal Laws Amendment Act, which authorized corporal punishment for defiers. The government tried a number of underhanded means to interrupt the campaign. Government propagandists repeatedly claimed that the leaders of the campaign were living it up in comfort while the masses were languishing in jail. This allegation was far from the truth, but it achieved a certain currency. The government also infiltrated spies and agent provocateurs into the organization. The ANC welcomed virtually anyone who wanted to join. In spite of the fact that our volunteers were carefully screened before they were selected to defy, the police managed to penetrate not only our local branches, but some of the batches of defiers. When I was arrested and sent to Marshall Square, I noticed two fellows among the defiers, one of whom I had never seen before. He wore unusual prison garb, a suit and tie with an overcoat and a silk scarf. What kind of fellow goes to jail dressed like that? His name was Ramaila, and on the third day when we were due to be released, he simply vanished. The second fellow, whose name was Makanda, stood out because of his military demeanor. We were out in the courtyard, and we were all in high spirits. The defiers would march in front of Yusuf and myself and salute us. Makanda, who was tall and slender, marched in a soldierly manner and then gave a crisp, graceful salute. A number of the fellows teased him that he must be a policeman to salute so well. Makanda had previously worked as a janitor at ANC headquarters. He was very industrious and was popular among the fellows because he would run out and get fish and chips whenever anyone was hungry. But at a later trial, we discovered that both Makanda and Ramaila were police spies. Ramaila testified that he had infiltrated the ranks of the defiers. The trusty Makanda was actually Detective Sergeant Matlong. Africans who worked as spies against their own brothers generally did so for money. Many blacks in South Africa believed that any effort by the black men to challenge the white man was foolhardy and doomed to failure. The white man was too smart and too strong. These spies saw us as a threat not to the white power structure, but to black interests, for whites would mistreat all blacks based on the conduct of a few agitators. Yet there were many black policemen who secretly aided us. They were decent fellows and found themselves in a moral quandary. They were loyal to their employer and needed to keep their jobs to support their families, but they were sympathetic to our cause. We had an understanding with a handful of African officers who were members of the security police that they would inform us when there was going to be a police raid. These men were patriots who risked their lives to help the struggle. The government was not our only impediment. Others who might have helped us instead hindered us. At the height of the defiance campaign, the United Party sent two of its MPs to urge us to halt the campaign. They said that if we abandoned our campaign in response to a call made by J.G.N. Strauss, the United Party leader, it would help the party defeat the nationalists in the next election. We rejected this, and Strauss proceeded to attack us with the same scorn used by the nationalists. We also came under attack from a breakaway ANC group called the National-Minded Bloc, led by Selope Tema, a former member of the National Executive Committee. The group bolted from the ANC when J.B. Marx was elected president of the Transvaal ANC. Tema, who was editor of the newspaper The Bantu World, fiercely criticized the campaign in his paper, claiming that communists had taken over the ANC and that Indians were exploiting the Africans. He asserted that the communists were more dangerous now that they were working underground, and that Indian economic interests were in conflict with those of Africans. Although he was in a minority in the ANC, his views got a sympathetic hearing among certain radical youth leaguers. In May, during the middle of the Defiance campaign, J.B. Marks was banned under the 1950 Suppression of Communism Act for furthering the aims of communism. Banning was a legal order by the government and generally entailed forced resignation from indicated organizations and restriction from attending gatherings of any kind. It was a kind of walking imprisonment. To ban a person, the government required no proof, offered no charges. The Minister of Justice simply declared it so. It was a strategy designed to remove the individual from the struggle, allowing him to live a narrowly defined life outside of politics. To violate or ignore a banning order was to invite imprisonment. At the Transvaal Conference that year in October, my name was proposed to replace the banned J.B. Marks, who had recommended that I succeed him. I was the national president of the Youth League and the favorite for Marx's position. But my candidacy was opposed by a group from within the Transvaal ANC that called itself Those Who Die Dancing. The group consisted mainly of ex-communists turned extreme African nationalists. They sought to cut all links with Indian activists and to move the ANC in the direction of a more confrontational strategy. They were led by MacDonald Maseko, a former communist who had been chairman of the Orlando branch of the ANC during the Defiance campaign, and Sirepareperi Marupeng, who had been the chief volunteer for the Defiance campaign in the Witwatersrand. Both Maseko and Marupeng intended to stand for the presidency of the Transvaal. Marupeng was considered something of a demagogue. He used to wear a military-style khaki suit replete with epaulettes and gold buttons and carried a baton like that made famous by Field Marshal Montgomery. He would stand up in front of meetings, his baton clutched underneath his arm, and say, "I am tired of waiting for freedom. I want freedom now. I will meet Milan at the crossroads, and I will show him what I want." Then, banging his baton on the podium, he would cry, "I want freedom now!" Because of speeches like these, Marupeng became extremely popular during the Defiance campaign. But popularity is only one factor in an election. He thought that because of his newfound prominence, he would win the presidency. Before the election, when it was known that I would be a candidate for the presidency, I approached him and said, "I would like you to stand for election to the executive, so that you can serve with me when I am president." He regarded this as a slight, that I was in effect demoting him, and he refused, choosing instead to run for the presidency himself. But he had miscalculated, for I won the election with an overwhelming majority. On July 30th, 1952, at the height of the Defiance campaign, I was at work at my then law firm H.M. Basner when the police arrived with a warrant for my arrest. The charge was violation of the Suppression of Communism Act. The state made a series of simultaneous arrests of campaign leaders in Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth, and Kimberley. Earlier in the month, the police had raided homes and offices of ANC and SAIC officials all over the country and confiscated papers and documents. This type of raid was something new and set a pattern for the pervasive and illegal searches that subsequently became a regular feature of the government's behavior. My arrest and those of the others culminated in a trial in September in Johannesburg of 21 accused, including the presidents and general secretaries of the ANC, the SAIC, the ANC Youth League, and the Transvaal Indian Congress. Among the 21 on trial in Johannesburg were Dr. Maroka, Walter Sisulu, and J.B. Marks. A number of Indian leaders were arrested, including Dr. Dadu, Yusuf Kachalia, and Ahmed Kathrada. Our appearances in court became the occasion for exuberant political rallies. Massive crowds of demonstrators marched through the streets of Johannesburg and converged on the city's magistrates' court. There were white students from the University of the Witwatersrand, old ANC campaigners from Alexandra, Indian schoolchildren from primary and secondary schools, people of all ages and colors. The court had never been deluged with such crowds before. The courtroom itself was packed with people, and shouts of "Mayebuye Africa" punctuated the proceedings. The trial should have been an occasion of resolve and solidarity, but was sullied by a breach of faith by Dr. Moroka. Dr. Moroka, the President General of the ANC and the figurehead of the campaign, shocked us all by employing his own attorney. The plan was for all of us to be tried together. My fellow accused designated me to discuss the matter with Dr. Moroka and attempt to persuade him not to separate himself. The day before the trial, I went to see Dr. Moroka at Village Deep, Johannesburg. At the outset of our meeting, I suggested alternatives to him, but he was not interested, and instead aired a number of grievances. Dr. Moroka felt that he had been excluded from the planning of the campaign. Yet Moroka was often quite uninterested in ANC affairs and content to be so. But he said that the matter that disturbed him more than any other was that by being defended with the rest of us, he would be associated with men who were communists. Dr. Moroka shared the government's animosity to communism. I remonstrated with him and said that it was the tradition of the ANC to work with anyone who was against racial oppression. But Dr. Moroka was unmoved. The greatest jolt came when Dr. Moroka tendered a humiliating plea in mitigation to Judge Rampf and took the witness stand to renounce the very principles on which the ANC had been founded. Asked whether he thought there should be equality between black and white in South Africa, Dr. Moroka replied that there would never be such a thing. We felt like slumping in despair in our seats. When his own lawyer asked him whether there were some among the defendants who were communists, Dr. Moroka actually began to point his finger at various people, including Dr. Dadu and Walter. The judge informed him that that was not necessary. His performance was a severe blow to the organization, and we all immediately realized that Dr. Moroka's days as ANC president were numbered. He had committed the cardinal sin of putting his own interests ahead of the organization and the people. He was unwilling to jeopardize his medical career and fortune for his political beliefs. Thereby, he had destroyed the image that he had built during 3 years of courageous work on behalf of the ANC and the Defiance campaign. I regarded this as a tragedy, for Dr. Moroka's faint-heartedness in court took away some of the glow from the campaign. The man who had gone round the country preaching the importance of the campaign had now forsaken it. On December 2nd, we were all found guilty of what Judge Rumpf defined as statutory communism, as opposed to what he said is commonly known as communism. According to the statutes of the Suppression of Communism Act, virtually anyone who opposed the government in any way could be defined as, and therefore convicted of, being a statutory communist, even without ever having been a member of the party. The judge, who was fair-minded and reasonable, said that although we had planned acts that ranged from open non-compliance of laws to something that equals high treason, he accepted that we had consistently advised our members to follow a peaceful course of action and to avoid violence in any shape or form. We were sentenced to 9 months' imprisonment with hard labor, but the sentence was suspended for 2 years. We made many mistakes, but the Defiance campaign marked a new chapter in the struggle. The 6 laws we singled out were not overturned, but we never had any illusion that they would be. We selected them as the most immediate burden pressing on the lives of the people, and the best way to engage the greatest number of people in the struggle. Prior to the campaign, the ANC was more talk than action. We had no paid organizers, no staff, and a membership that did little more than pay lip service to our cause. As a result of the campaign, our membership swelled to 100,000. The ANC emerged as a truly mass-based organization, with an impressive core of experienced activists who had braved the police, the courts, and the jails. The stigma usually associated with imprisonment had been removed. This was a significant achievement, for fear of prison is a tremendous hindrance to a liberation struggle. From the Defiance campaign onward, going to prison became a badge of honor among Africans. We were extremely proud of the fact that during the 6 months of the campaign, there was not a single act of violence on our side. The discipline of our resistors was exemplary. During the latter part of the campaign, riots broke out in Port Elizabeth and East London in which more than 40 people were killed. Though these outbreaks had nothing whatsoever to do with the campaign, the government attempted to link us with them. In this, the government was successful, for the riots poisoned the views of some whites who might otherwise have been sympathetic. Some within the ANC had unrealistic expectations and were convinced that the campaign could topple the government. We reminded them that the idea of the campaign was to focus attention on our grievances, not eradicate them. They argued that we had the government where we wanted them and that we should continue the campaign indefinitely. I stepped in and said that this government was too strong and too ruthless to be brought down in such a manner. We could embarrass them, but overthrowing them as a result of the Defiance campaign was impossible. As it was, we continued the campaign for too long. We should have listened to Dr. Tsuma. The planning committee met with Dr. Tsuma during the tail end of the campaign, and he told us that the campaign would soon lose momentum and it would be wise to call it off before it fizzled out altogether. To halt the campaign while it was still on the offensive would be a shrewd move that would capture the headlines. Dr. Tsuma was right. The campaign soon slackened, but in our enthusiasm and even arrogance, we brushed aside his advice. My heart wanted to keep the campaign going, but my head told me that it should stop. I argued for closure, but went along with the majority. By the end of the year, the campaign foundered. The campaign never expanded beyond the initial stage of small batches of mostly urban defiers. Mass defiance, especially in the rural areas, was never achieved. The Eastern Cape was the only region where we succeeded in reaching the second stage and where a strong resistance movement emerged in the countryside. In general, we did not penetrate the countryside, an historical weakness of the ANC. The campaign was hampered by the fact that we did not have any full-time organizers. I was attempting to organize the campaign and practice as a lawyer at the same time, and that is no way to wage a mass campaign. We were still amateurs. I nevertheless felt a great sense of accomplishment and satisfaction. I had been engaged in a just cause and had the strength to fight for it and win. The campaign freed me from any lingering sense of doubt or inferiority I might still have felt. It liberated me from the feeling of being overwhelmed by the power and seeming invincibility of the white man and his institutions. But now, the white man had felt the power of my punches, and I could walk upright like a man, and look everyone in the eye with the dignity that comes from not having succumbed to oppression and fear. I had come of age as a freedom fighter. Part 4. The Struggle is My Life. Chapter 15. At the ANC annual conference at the end of 1952, there was a changing of the guard. The ANC designated a new, more vigorous president for a new, more activist era, Chief Albert Luthuli. In accordance with the ANC constitution, as provisional president of the Transvaal, I became one of the four deputy presidents. Furthermore, the National Executive Committee appointed me as first deputy president, in addition to my position as president of the Transvaal. Latuli was one of a handful of ruling chiefs who were active in the ANC and had staunchly resisted the policies of the government. The son of a Seventh-day Adventist missionary, Latuli was born in what was then southern Rhodesia and educated in Natal. He trained as a teacher at Adams College near Durban. A fairly tall, heavy-set, dark-skinned man with a great, broad smile, he combined an air of humility with deep-seated confidence. He was a man of patience and fortitude, who spoke slowly and clearly, as though every word was of equal importance. I had first met him in the late 1940s, when he was a member of the Natives' Representative Council. In September of 1952, only a few months before the annual conference, Latuli had been summoned to Pretoria and given an ultimatum. He must either renounce his membership in the ANC and his support of the Defiance campaign, or he would be dismissed from his position as an elected and government-paid tribal chief. Latuli was a teacher, a devout Christian, and a proud Zulu chief, but he was even more firmly committed to the struggle against apartheid. Latuli refused to resign from the ANC, and the government dismissed him from his post. In response to his dismissal, he issued a statement of principles called The Road to Freedom is Via the Cross, in which he reaffirmed his support for non-violent passive resistance and justified his choice with words that still echo plaintively today. Who will deny that 30 years of my life have been spent knocking in vain, patiently, moderately, and modestly at a closed and barred door? I supported Chief Latuli, but I was unable to attend the national conference. A few days before the conference was to begin, 52 leaders around the country were banned from attending any meetings or gatherings for 6 months. I was among those leaders, and my movements were restricted to the district of Johannesburg for that same period. My bans extended to meetings of all kinds, not just political ones. I could not, for example, attend my son's birthday party. I was prohibited from talking to more than one person at a time. This was part of a systematic effort by the government to silence, persecute, and immobilize the leaders of those fighting apartheid, and was the first of a series of bans on me that continued with brief intervals of freedom until the time I was deprived of all freedom some years hence. Banning not only confines one physically, it imprisons one's spirit. It induces a kind of psychological claustrophobia that makes one yearn not only for freedom of movement, but spiritual escape. Banning was a dangerous game, for one was not shackled or chained behind bars. The bars were laws and regulations that could easily be violated, and often were. One could slip away unseen for short periods of time and have the temporary illusion of freedom. The insidious effect of bans was that at a certain point, one began to think that the oppressor was not without, but within. Although I was prevented from attending the 1952 annual conference, I was immediately informed as to what had transpired. One of the most significant decisions was one taken in secret and not publicized at the time. Along with many others, I had become convinced that the government intended to declare the ANC and the SAIC illegal organizations, just as it had done with the Communist Party. It seemed inevitable that the state would attempt to put us out of business as a legal organization as soon as it could. With this in mind, I approached the National Executive Committee with the idea that we must come up with a contingency plan for just such an eventuality. I said it would be an abdication of our responsibility as leaders of the people if we did not do so. They instructed me to draw up a plan that would enable the organization to operate from underground. This strategy came to be known as the Mandela Plan, or simply M Plan. The idea was to set up organizational machinery that would allow the ANC to make decisions at the highest level, which could then be swiftly transmitted to the organization as a whole without calling a meeting. In other words, it would allow an illegal organization to continue to function and enable leaders who were banned to continue to lead. The M plan was designed to allow the organization to recruit new members, respond to local and national problems, and maintain regular contact between the membership and the underground leadership. I held a number of secret meetings among ANC and SAIC leaders, both banned and not banned, to discuss the parameters of the plan. I worked on it for a number of months and came up with a system that was broad enough to adapt itself to local conditions and not fetter individual initiative, but detailed enough to facilitate order. The smallest unit was the cell, which in urban townships consisted of roughly 10 houses on a street. A cell steward would be in charge of each of these units. If a street had more than 10 houses, a street steward would take charge, and the cell stewards would report to him. A group of streets formed a zone directed by a chief steward, who was in turn responsible to the secretariat of the local branch of the ANC. The secretariat was a subcommittee of the branch executive, which reported to the provincial secretary. My notion was that every cell and street steward should know every person and family in his area, so that he would be trusted by the people and would know whom to trust. The cell steward arranged meetings, organized political classes, and collected dues. He was the linchpin of the plan. Although the strategy was primarily created for more urban areas, it could be adapted to rural ones. The plan was accepted and was to be implemented immediately. Word went out to the branches to begin to prepare for this covert restructuring. The plan was accepted at most branches, but some of the more far-flung outposts felt that the plan was an effort by Johannesburg to centralize control over the regions. As part of the M plan, the ANC introduced an elementary course of political lectures for its members throughout the country. These lectures were meant not only to educate, but to hold the organization together. The lectures were given in secret by branch leaders. Those members in attendance would in turn give the same lectures to others in their homes and communities. In the beginning, the lectures were not systemized, but within a number of months, there was a set curriculum. There were three courses: The World We Live In, How We Are Governed, and The Need for Change. In the first course, we discussed the different types of political and economic systems around the world as well as in South Africa. It was an overview of the growth of capitalism as well as socialism. We discussed, for example, how blacks in South Africa were oppressed both as a race and an economic class. The lecturers were mostly band members, and I myself frequently gave lectures in the evening. This arrangement had the virtue of keeping band individuals active, as well as keeping the membership in touch with these leaders. During this time, the band leadership would often meet secretly and alone, and then arrange to meet the present leaders. The old and the new leadership meshed very well, and the decision-making process was collective as it had been before. Sometimes it felt as if nothing had changed except that we had to meet in secret. The M plan was conceived with the best intentions, but it was instituted with only modest success, and its adoption was never widespread. The most impressive results were once again in the Eastern Cape and Port Elizabeth. The spirit of the Defiance campaign continued in the Eastern Cape long after it vanished elsewhere, and ANC members there seized on the M plan as a way of continuing to defy the government. The plan faced many problems. It was not always adequately explained to the membership. There were no paid organizers to help implement or administer it, and there was often dissension within branches that prevented agreement on imposing the plan. Some provincial leaders resisted it because they believed it undermined their power. To some, the government's crackdown did not seem imminent, so they did not take the precautions necessary to lessen its effect. When the government's iron fist did descend, they were not prepared. Chapter 16. My life during the Defiance campaign ran on two separate tracks, my work in the struggle and my livelihood as an attorney. I was never a full-time organizer for the ANC. The organization had only one, and that was Thomas Titus Nkobe. The work I did had to be arranged around my schedule as an attorney. In 1951, after I had completed my articles at Witkin, Sedelsky, and Eidelman, I went to work for the law firm of Terblanche and Brigish. When I completed my articles, I was not yet a fully fledged attorney, but I was in a position to draw court pleadings, send out summonses, interview witnesses, all of which an attorney must do before a case goes to court. After leaving Sedelsky, I had investigated a number of white firms. There were, of course, no African law firms. I was particularly interested in the scale of fees charged by these firms and was outraged to discover that many of the most blue-chip law firms charged Africans even higher fees for criminal and civil cases than they did their far wealthier white clients. After working for Terblanche and Brigish for about 1 year, I joined the firm of Hellman and Michael. It was a liberal firm and one of the few that charged Africans on a reasonable scale. In addition, the firm prided itself on its devotion to African education, toward which they donated handsomely. Mr. Hellman, the firm's senior partner, was involved with African causes long before they became popular or fashionable. The firm's other partner, Rodney Michael, a veteran of World War II, was also extremely liberal. He was a pilot, and years later helped fly ANC people out of South Africa during the worst periods of repression. Michael's only discernible vice was that he was a heavy smoker who puffed on one cigarette after another all day long at the office. I stayed at Hellman and Michael for a number of months while I was studying for my qualification exam, which would establish me as a fully fledged attorney. I had given up studying for an LLB degree at the University of the Witwatersrand after failing my exams several times. I opted to take the qualifying exam so that I could practice and begin to earn enough money to support my family. At the time, my sister was living with us, and my mother had come to visit, and Evelyn's wages as a nurse trainee, plus my own paltry income, were not enough to keep everyone warm and fed. When I passed the qualification exam, I went to work as a fully-fledged attorney at the firm of H.M. Basner. Basner had been an African representative in the Senate, an early member of the Communist Party, and a passionate supporter of African rights. As a lawyer, he was a defender of African leaders and trade unionists. For the months that I worked there, I was often in court representing the firm's many African clients. Mr. Basner was an excellent boss, and as long as I got my work done at the firm, he encouraged my political work. After the experience I gained there, I felt ready to go off on my own. In August of 1952, I opened my own law office. What early success I enjoyed, I owed to Zubeda Patel, my secretary. I had met her when she had gone to work at H.M. Basner as a replacement for an Afrikaans-speaking secretary, Miss Koch, who had refused to take my dictation. Zubeda was the wife of my friend Kasim Patel, a member of the Indian Congress, and she was without any sense of color bar whatsoever. She had a wide circle of friends, knew many people in the legal world, and when I went out on my own, she agreed to work for me. She brought a great deal of business through the door. Oliver Tambo was then working for a firm called Kowalski and Tush. I often visited him there during his lunch hour and made a point of sitting in a whites-only chair in the whites-only waiting room. Oliver and I were very good friends, and we mainly discussed ANC business during those lunch hours. He had first impressed me at Fort Hare, where I noticed his thoughtful intelligence and sharp debating skills. With his cool, logical style, he could demolish an opponent's argument, precisely the sort of intelligence that is useful in a courtroom. Before Fort Hare, he had been a brilliant student at St. Peter's in Johannesburg. His even-tempered objectivity was an antidote to my more emotional reactions to issues. Oliver was deeply religious and had for a long time considered the ministry to be his calling. He was also a neighbor. He came from Bizana in Pandoland, part of the Transkei, and his face bore the distinctive scars of his tribe. It seemed natural for us to practice together, and I asked him to join me. A few months later, when Oliver was able to extricate himself from his firm, we opened our own office in downtown Johannesburg. Mandela and Tambo, read the brass plate on our office door in Chancellor House, a small building just across the street from the marble statues of justice standing in front of the magistrate's court in central Johannesburg. Our building, owned by Indians, was one of the few places where Africans could rent offices in the city. From the beginning, Mandela and Tambo was besieged with clients. We were not the only African lawyers in South Africa, but we were the only firm of African lawyers. For Africans, we were the firm of first choice and last resort. To reach our offices each morning, we had to move through a crowd of people in the hallways, on the stairs, and in our small waiting room. Africans were desperate for legal help in government buildings. It was a crime to walk through a whites-only door, a crime to ride a whites-only bus, a crime to use a whites-only drinking fountain, a crime to walk on a whites-only beach, a crime to be on the streets past 11, a crime not to have a passbook, and a crime to have the wrong signature in that book, a crime to be unemployed, and a crime to be employed in the wrong place, a crime to live in certain places, and a crime to have no place to live. Every week we interviewed old men from the countryside who told us that generation after generation of their family had worked a scraggly piece of land from which they were now being evicted. Every week we interviewed old women who brewed African beer as a way to supplement their tiny incomes, who now faced jail terms and fines they could not afford to pay. Every week we interviewed people who had lived in the same house for decades, only to find that it was now declared a white area, and they had to leave without any recompense at all. Every day we heard and saw the thousands of humiliations that ordinary Africans confronted every day of their lives. Oliver had a prodigious capacity for work. He spent a great deal of time with each client, not so much for professional reasons, but because he was a man of limitless compassion and patience. He became involved in his clients' cases and in their lives. He was touched by the plight of the masses as a whole, and by each and every individual. I realized quickly what Mandela and Tambo meant to ordinary Africans. It was a place where they could come and find a sympathetic ear and a competent ally, a place where they would not be either turned away or cheated, a place where they might actually feel proud to be represented by men of their own skin color. This was the reason I had become a lawyer in the first place, and my work often made me feel I had made the right decision. We often dealt with a half dozen cases in a morning, and were in and out of court all day long. In some courts we were treated with courtesy, in others we were treated with contempt. But even as we practiced and fought and won cases, we always knew that no matter how well we pursued our careers as attorneys, we could never become a prosecutor, a magistrate, a judge. Although we were dealing with officials whose competence was no greater than our own, their authority was founded on and protected by the color of their skin. We frequently encountered prejudice in the court itself. White witnesses often refused to answer questions from a black attorney. Instead of citing them for contempt of court, the magistrate would then pose the questions they would not answer from me. I routinely put policemen on the stand and interrogated them, though I would catch them in discrepancies and lies. They never considered me anything but a Kaffir lawyer. I recall once being asked at the outset of a trial to identify myself. This was customary. I said, "I am Nelson Mandela and I appear for the accused." The magistrate said, "I don't know you. Where is your certificate?" A certificate is the fancy diploma that one frames and hangs on the wall. It is not something that an attorney ever carries with him. It would be like asking a man for his university degree. I requested that the magistrate begin the case, and I would bring in my certificate in due course. But the magistrate refused to hear the case, even going so far as to ask a court officer to evict me. This was a clear violation of court practice. The matter eventually came before the Supreme Court, and my friend George Bisos, an advocate, appeared on my behalf. At the hearing, the presiding judge criticized the conduct of the magistrate and ordered that a different magistrate must hear the case. Being a lawyer did not guarantee respect out of court either. One day, near our office, I saw an elderly white woman whose motor car was sandwiched between two cars. I immediately went over and pushed the car, which helped free it. The English-speaking woman turned to me and said, "Thank you, John." John being the name whites use to address any African whose name they did not know. She then handed me a sixpence coin, which I politely refused. She pushed it toward me, and again I said, "No, thank you." She then exclaimed, "You refuse a sixpence. You must want a shilling, but you shall not have it," and then threw the coin at me and drove off. Within a year, Oliver and I discovered that under the Urban Areas Act, we were not permitted to occupy business premises in the city without ministerial consent. Our request was denied, and we received instead a temporary permit under the Group Areas Act, which soon expired. The authorities refused to renew it, insisting that we move our offices to an African location many miles away and virtually unreachable for our clients. We interpreted this as an effort by the authorities to put us out of business and occupied our premises illegally, with threats of eviction constantly hanging over our heads. Working as a lawyer in South Africa meant operating under a debased system of justice, a code of law that did not enshrine equality, but its opposite. One of the most pernicious examples of this is the Population Registration Act, which defined that inequality. I once handled the case of a colored man who was inadvertently classified as an African. He had fought for South Africa during World War II in North Africa and Italy, but after his return, a white bureaucrat had reclassified him as African. This was the type of case, not at all untypical in South Africa, that offered a moral jigsaw puzzle. I did not support or recognize the principles in the Population Registration Act, but my client needed representation, and he had been classified as something he was not. There were many practical advantages to being classified as colored rather than African, such as the fact that colored men were not required to carry passes. On his behalf, I appealed to the Classification Board, which adjudicated cases falling under the Population Registration Act. The board consisted of a magistrate and two other officials, all white. I had formidable documentary evidence to establish my client's case, and the prosecutor formally indicated that he would not oppose our appeal. But the magistrate seemed uninterested in both my evidence and the prosecutor's demurral. He stared at my client and gruffly asked him to turn around so that his back faced the bench. After scrutinizing my client's shoulders, which sloped down sharply, he nodded to the other officials and upheld the appeal. In the view of the white authorities those days, sloping shoulders were one stereotype of the colored physique. And so it came about that the course of this man's life was decided purely on a magistrate's opinion about the structure of his shoulders. We tried many cases involving police brutality, though our success rate was quite low. Police assaults were always difficult to prove. The police were clever enough to detain a prisoner long enough for the wounds and bruises to heal, and often it was simply the word of a policeman against our client. The magistrates naturally sided with the police. The coroner's verdict on a death in police custody would often read, "Death due to multiple causes," or some vague explanation that let the police off the hook. Whenever I had a case outside Johannesburg, I applied to have my bans temporarily lifted, and this was often granted. For example, I traveled to the Eastern Transvaal and defended a client in the town of Carolina. My arrival caused quite a sensation, as many of the people had never before seen an African lawyer. I was received warmly by the magistrate and prosecutor, and the case did not begin for quite a while, as they asked me numerous questions about my career and how I became a lawyer. The court was similarly crowded with curious townspeople. In a nearby village, I appeared for a local medicine man charged with witchcraft. This case also attracted a large crowd, not to see me, but to find out whether the white man's laws could be applied to a Sangoma. The medicine man exerted tremendous power in the area, and many people both worshipped and feared him. At one point, my client sneezed violently, causing a virtual stampede in the courtroom. Most observers believed he was casting a spell. He was found not guilty, but I suspect that the local people attributed this not to my skill as a lawyer, but to the power of the medicine man's herbs. As an attorney, I could be rather flamboyant in court. I did not act as though I were a black man in a white man's court, but as if everyone else, white and black, was a guest in my court. When trying a case, I often made sweeping gestures and used high-flown language. I was punctilious about all court regulations, but I sometimes used unorthodox tactics with witnesses. I enjoyed cross-examinations and often played on racial tension. The spectators' gallery was usually crowded because people from the township attended court as a form of entertainment. I recall once defending an African woman employed as a domestic worker in town. She was accused of stealing her madam's clothes. The clothing that was allegedly stolen was displayed on a table in court. After the madam had testified, I began my cross-examination by walking over to the table of evidence. I perused the clothing and then, with the tip of my pencil, I picked up an item of ladies' underwear. I slowly turned to the witness box, brandishing the panties, and simply asked, "Madam, are these yours?" "No," she replied quickly, too embarrassed to admit that they were hers. Because of this response and other discrepancies in her evidence, the magistrate dismissed the case. Chapter 17. Situated 4 miles west of Johannesburg's center, on the face of a rocky outcrop overlooking the city, was the African township of Sophiatown. Father Trevor Huddleston, one of the township's greatest friends, once compared Sophiatown to an Italian hill town, and from a distance the place did indeed have a good deal of charm. The closely packed red-roofed houses, the smoke curling up into a pink sky, the tall and slender gum trees that hugged the township. Up close, one saw the poverty and squalor in which too many of Sophiatown's people lived. The streets were narrow and unpaved, and every lot was filled with dozens of shanties huddled close together. Sophiatown was part of what was known as the Western Area's townships, along with Martindale and New Clare. The area was originally intended for whites, and a real estate developer actually built a number of houses there for white buyers. But because of a municipal refuse dump in the area, whites chose to live elsewhere. Reluctantly, the developer sold his houses to Africans. Sophiatown was one of the few places in the Transvaal where Africans had been able to buy stands or plots prior to the 1923 Urban Areas Act. Many of these old brick and stone houses with their tin-roofed verandas still stood in Sophiatown, giving the township an air of old-world graciousness. As industry in Johannesburg grew, Sophiatown became the home of a rapidly expanding African workforce. It was convenient and close to town. Workers lived in shanties that were erected in the back and front yards of older residences. Several families might all be crowded into a single shanty. Up to 40 people could share a single water tap. Despite the poverty, Sophiatown had a special character. For Africans, it was the Left Bank in Paris, Greenwich Village in New York, the home of writers, artists, doctors, and lawyers. It was both bohemian and conventional, lively and sedate. It was home to both Dr. Thuma, where he had his practice, and assorted sotsies, gangsters, like the Berliners and the Americans who adopted the names of American movie stars like John Wayne and Humphrey Bogart. So Firetown boasted the only swimming pool for African children in Johannesburg. In Johannesburg, the Western Area's removal scheme meant the evacuation of Sophiatown, Martindale, and New Clare, with a collective population that was somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000. In 1953, the nationalist government had purchased a tract of land called Meadowlands, 13 miles from the city.